The official history reports a minor incident, really, in the context of the Great War. It says number 3 section of the 82nd Field Company Royal Engineers, working under the 57th Brigade 19th Division, was engaged under fire in building strong points in front of Bazatine-le-Petit village during the night of the 29th and the 30th of July 1916. The infantry assisting the section was withdrawn to prepare for an attack the next day, but the sappers volunteered to go on with the work and did so until 9 were killed and nearly all the others wounded. Several years later, a Colonel Butterworth wrote a letter to a magazine called Sapper, the Journal of the Royal Engineers. And he was the commanding officer of that unit that night. And he wrote, number 3 and 4 sections has to go up at dusk through the little village of Bazantine to wire in some tactical points gained during the day's fighting. They had 2 or 3 men hit on the way up, and then for 3 or 4 hours they carried on their work under a hellish storm of high explosives and machine gun fire. The work was considered vitally necessary. Accordingly, Lieutenant Howlett carried on steadfastly with number 4 section and CSM Diamond with number 3 section till the work was through. 6 killed and 19 wounded out of 40. I added the names of 3 others who died with great heroism, sticking it in the same way on the previous night, thus making up the tale of the 9 brave men. Coate was a first-rate carpenter and a most lovable man. Ellison, just a boy from a North Country workshop. Vernon, a fitter and a fine stalwart fellow. 3 days later, the unit left the area and Captain Butterworth handed over command. But what he said was, however, I had written to each of the next of kin of the 9 men, adding that I marked the spot and I would go back some day and put up a little stone to their memory. I had a block of granite engraved in the divisional workshop. We collected bricks from the ruins nearby and so constructed our small tribute of affection and respecting to the memory of our 9 brave comrades. Now that memorial, like so many private memorials on the battlefields, have fallen into disrepair over the years until Terry Berry and Rick Smith of the Western Front Services came along and used their skills to repair it. And last week, along with another memorial just a few hundred yards up the road, it was rededicated in a ceremony that was held in pouring rain but attended by many people that had come over, especially from the UK, and also many people from the local community on the Somme. Lots of French people were there. And what was that other memorial? Well, there's a man I've known for many years called Stephen Benson, and he's so passionate about the men from Cheshire that he formed an organisation and set up a website called the Cheshire Roll of Honour. And he's done such tremendous work researching men from his home county. But a few years ago, he discovered the memorial of a man called Captain Houston Wallace of the 10th Battalion of the Worcestershire Regiment, killed in action on the 22nd of July 1916. He has no known grave and, like so many others, remembered on the Teatvale Memorial. He came from Birkenhead in Cheshire, of course, where Stephen himself was from, and was born in 1892. He went to a public school in Edinburgh for 6 years, where he became a school prefect. He was captain of the cricket and the hockey team, and he was a sergeant in the officers' training corps. And then he went up to Merton College in Oxford in 1912, but as soon as war came along, he volunteered for service. He was commissioned into the Worcesters in October of 1914. He went to France in the following July, and a year later, around Les Boisselles, they suffered heavy casualties. But later that month, they were in action in the attack on High Wood. And by this time, Wallace was a captain commanding D Company. Now, as they attacked across the open ground between Bazantine and High Wood, the Germans brought forward a gun in a bend in the road, and it caught Wallace and his company as they were advancing to attack. They took heavy casualties, and amongst them, Wallace himself was killed. Because he's on the Teatvale Memorial, it means his body was never found. Now, his parents had died before the war, but his next of kin, his auntie, Beatrice, did her best to discover what had happened to him. His commanding officer said he'd been buried near a Calvary with trees behind, and with other evidence, they found that this was a junction near a location known as the Windmill. And Miss Heap, his auntie, first went there in 1921. In March of 1924, Imperial War Graves Commission staff reported a new memorial on the site, and in the summer, Miss Heap approached the commission asking if they would look after it for a fee. She'd not bought the site, but merely replaced the Calvary which had been destroyed, dedicated it to her nephew, and cultivated a very small area. The commune of Bazantine welcomed the gift, but they couldn't look after it. The commission duly investigated, and in January 1925, the commission was empowered to maintain it for just 20 years, up until 1944. Miss Heap had paid for brick steps to be built and various improvements to be made, and then regular maintenance until the Second World War. And then after the war, it was forgotten about, really. Miss Heap could not be traced, and the memorial gradually fell into disrepair. In 1994, the Western Front Association sponsored work carried out by the local commune as a joint project. New parts were made for the original Calvary, a new plaque was attached to the restored cairn, the site was tidied up and planted, and a service of rededication was attended then by over 200 people. But as time goes on, of course, the memorial once again fell into disrepair until Stephen Benson came along and decided he needed to do something about it. And over the next 18 months or so, he crowdfunded enough money to restore it. And there, Stephen himself gathered with many of his friends and people that had helped him with the project. And an ITV news crew turned up. They recorded what happened. They spoke to Stephen himself. And they also spoke to Terry Berry, the man that I mentioned earlier had been involved in the restoration of the Nine Brave Men Memorial just along the road, and also carried out the work on the Wallace Memorial. Once again, it was raining, but it didn't put off anybody that was there the other day.
Dawn on the Somme. And away from the official war cemeteries, in farmers' fields and the surrounding French countryside lie over 70,000 British soldiers with no known grave. Amongst them, Captain Houston Wallace from Birkenhead, who died with two fellow officers attacking an enemy machine gun post near the village of Bazentin-le-Petit during World War I. This morning, the village returned en masse to the newly refurbished memorial erected in his memory near to where he died on July the 22nd, 1916. The private memorial, a wooden Calvary, was bought and placed here by this remarkable woman, Wallace's aunt, Beatrice Heap, after the end of World War I, to ensure he wouldn't be forgotten.
She was constantly in touch with the Imperial War Graves Commission, now the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, first of all to try and find where her nephew was buried, and then once she realised that he couldn't be found, she wanted him honoured with this memorial.
But after more than a century, it was on the verge of collapse until the organisation, the Cheshire Roll of Honour, stepped in.
You must not lose that history of these men who served and fought for our country. And to have those names listed, their stories there, is something that we can then cherish and use for future generations.
It's very important for us today because it's a very moving service in a small village like Bazentin. And the story is very moving too, with the Tante Beatrice and Wallace Stone. And we love this story because it's very, I think it's very important for us and for the people in Great Britain.
Although the work to rebuild the memorial to Captain Wallace wasn't without risk.
It was a British position, it was then a German position, and so we found, you know, bullets, grenades, shells from both sides.
200 metres from Wallace's Calvary, another memorial, this time to the so-called Nine Brave Men, Royal Engineers killed by enemy fire, including sapper Thomas Blakely from Lancashire. Before joining up, he played for Preston North End Reserves.
Sapper Thomas Blakely came from Preston. He played for Preston North End Reserves and for Southport Central. And sadly, he died quite a young man with a small family.
Wreaths were laid here too this morning. Before the focus returned to Wallace's private memorial. You know, it's quite strange to think that Captain Wallace's and Beatrice stood exactly here more than 100 years ago to ensure that a nephew would never be forgotten with this striking memorial. In many ways, the story is as much about her as him, Captain Wallace and Beatrice Heap. Paul Crone, ITV News, Northern France.
As this part of the podcast, we've talked about the memorials themselves. We've talked about the soldiers that were involved and the Royal Engineers sappers. But now what we'd like to do is talk to one of the main men that was involved in pulling all this together. You heard his voice there on the clip from ITV News, and Stephen Bentham from the Cheshire Roll of Honour. So very welcome to the podcast, Stephen. It's great to have you on. And
thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, it's great. So tell us more about it then, because we were just talking off air about the smaller memorial, the other memorial, sorry, the Nine Brave Men. How did that come about then? Because that wasn't the original plan then, was it, by all accounts?
No, the original plan was to concentrate on the Wallace Memorial. And the Nine Brave Men was just a couple of hundred metres up the road, and we noticed that it did need some basic repair work. So the idea was just to clean it up, repoint the walls, and then repaint the names onto the memorial. We found that over a period of time, the memorial was struck twice by farm machinery.
Right.
Which basically shattered the wall. So we managed to get permission from the mayor to move the memorial 2 or 3 metres back to give it more protection.
Yeah.
And that involved then having to have a new wall, new base, and moving the memorial into a safer position.
And so you had to get funding for that as well?
So we added that to the funding as well.
Right,
yes, so
it was all
separate then. They then basically became two separate projects.
Right, but crowdfunded in the same way, presumably.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Brilliant. So the one that you become interested in then was because of the Cheshire connection, presumably. Cheshire Roll of Honour, I think you started that off a few years ago, you were saying. Tell us more about that then, Stephen.
Yeah, so I started that 12 years ago, and it was the accumulation of probably 30 plus years of collecting names and photographs of war memorials all around the county of Cheshire. And I decided that I needed to do something about this information, so I created a county-wide roll. The roll now has over 33,000 names on it, and we're currently building two new databases, which is going to add another 47,000 names. And every soldier has his own page, and we have a small group of volunteers, 11 at the moment, who research each individual to tell a story on that individual soldier.
So these are people not necessarily that fought with one of the Cheshire battalions. These are people that lived in the big county of Cheshire.
That's right. To qualify, you just had to either live or have been born in the county.
Mm.
In fact, from the Cheshire Regiment point of view, for the First World War, it's only a third of the people actually served with the regiment.
Mm. And if people have got relatives that they want to submit to you, then they can contact you through your website?
That's right. There's a contact page there. They can come forward to us. We'll pass it on to one of the volunteers.
Yeah.
We may already have information. There may be information already on the page for that soldier. There may even be a photograph that they've never seen before.
Great.
We do get hit a lot. We had 1.4 million page views last year.
Wow, that's not bad then, is it?
On the website, yeah.
You've still got a lot of work to do.
All the time.
Your project will never end, will it?
No, we'll never finish it. I'll never complete it in my lifetime.
No.
Because for every day is school day, and yeah, we learn new more bits and pieces about individuals.
Yeah, we do have this conversation every day, don't we, with different historians, different people that have an interest.
Absolutely.
And so how did you stumble upon, literally stumble upon that broken memorial at Bazantine then?
Well, I knew the memorial was there from the Barry Thorpe, from the Western Front Association.
Yeah.
And which was done in, I think it was done in the 90s. I was planning a walk with a group of ramblers, actually from Chelmsford, but a couple of people originally came from Cheshire. And I was planning a walk around Bazantine and up to High Wood, and part of that walk was going to incorporate stopping at the memorial. And when we were there, I was kind of shocked to the state of it. You couldn't get up the bank.
No.
You could hardly see the memorial. The cairn itself was crumbling. The Calvary was rotten.
Mm.
And I decided then I need to do something about it.
Mm.
So I started the project to get the land and the Calvary renovated.
And was that a complicated project?
It did have its moments. because it's on communal land, you have to get permission from the mayor of the village. But to be fair, he bought into it straight away and was delighted, you know, what the plans were. And he's been really helpful throughout the project.
And what about relatives of Wallace? Did you manage to track down any?
Yeah, so that's a very complicated web, unfortunately. Houston was an only child. His parents had died before the war.
Mm.
So it was his Aunt Beatrice who was his next of kin.
Yeah.
She never married. But she did have a younger sister, Margaret. Margaret did marry. She went on to have children. And we've traced the family now to Brighton in the late 70s and early 80s. But we do know that Houston had 23 other relatives, children.
Yeah.
In his age bracket. But it's tracking all those down individually because obviously names are changing as people get married.
Yeah.
It becomes a bit of a web.
Yeah.
So if anybody is listening and they do know, then, you know, we'd really love to get hold of some family.
No, so didn't manage to get anybody there for the ceremony because we haven't been able to track them down, no. I suppose, at this stage.
Unfortunately, no.
No. Okay. And how did it feel to you then on the day?
Difficult one.
It looked like you were quite emotional in the pictures that I saw.
I was very emotional. There was a couple of moments after, you know, nearly 3 years of getting the job done.
Yeah.
There was lots of moments that I really felt very emotional about it all. Yeah.
I mean, I know you well, you know, from days gone by, and I know you're a very emotional man. I know that you are deeply affected by the stories that you've researched. So this really must have dug deep in your heart then, mustn't it, through this process?
It did. And you know, there was a little twist which I'd like to tell you, which
please,
you might be, you know, be interested to hear.
Yeah.
Is that I contacted the Worcestershire Regimental Association. They came back to me, and the person who came back to me was a gentleman called Nigel Fish, who was the chairman of the association. When Houston was killed on the 22nd of July 1916, a letter that Beatrice received from his commanding officer said that Houston had been buried with two brother officers, one whose name was Fish.
Right. Ooh.
So this kind of started a whole new chain. We now do, Nigel, who is now looking into the fact that his relative might be the second Lieutenant Fish, who was killed and buried with Houston.
Yeah.
On the 22nd of July, 1916. So Jack Fish, as his first name was, he was found in 1927.
Right.
And now he's now buried at AFI Burial Ground at Fleurs.
Yeah.
So what we did was we've got the location of where Jack Fish was found from the Commonwealth War Graves
burial
records.
Report, yeah.
So we walked down to the spot and we placed three poppy crosses to the three officers that were killed and supposedly buried together. No other bodies were found, so we don't know for definite whether Houston and Warren Tree were definitely buried with Jackfish.
Yeah.
But there's certainly a letter to assume that they were.
And two things that are coming out of that. And firstly, because Beatrice always was told that where the memorial is situated is where he died, and presumably where he was buried. Yep. How far away is the spot where Fish was found then?
About 150 yards.
Oh, right. So it all stacks up then, doesn't it? It's as near as near as you can get.
It all stacks up. Yeah.
Yeah. And the guy down at the Regimental Museum, the Worcester, is this Fish, is it a coincidence or is it a relative?
He doesn't know. He actually didn't know there was a Fish in the Worcestershire Regiment.
So your ears pricked up then as soon as you realised you were talking to Mr. Fish?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, when I told him, he was absolutely stunned.
I bet he would.
Because he didn't know.
Yeah.
And strangely enough, when we met last week, he did actually say to me, his daughter, who lives in London, actually walks past Jack Fish, his house where Jack Fish lived in before the First World War.
And where did he live?
In London.
In London. In London. Right. Right. Yes. Blimey. Yeah. Honestly, it just happens all the time, doesn't it? There is never an end to this. The coincidences.
No.
And it's almost meant to happen. It's almost as though those three men are drawing you into them, isn't it? With new information.
Absolutely.
And you'd like to think that he was looking down on that beautiful ceremony that you held the other day, which was, it was raining, wasn't it? I noticed. It was raining on the day that the original memorial was dedicated as well.
in 1994?
Yeah.
The one in 1994.
Yeah, the Western Front one, yeah. Yeah, so it's ironic, isn't it? I wonder what the weather was like on the day, 22nd of July, 1916. I suppose that was a nice day, wasn't it?
it probably wasn't. But Beatrice unveiled, well, didn't unveil them. She finished the memorial in 1924.
Yeah.
So the photo, you know, not many people have seen the photograph of Beatrice standing at the memorial.
Yes.
In 1924.
Yes.
And you can see the land at the back is completely devastated. And we know that Beatrice must have gone at least two more times or twice more to the memorial.
When I read the Western Front Association article about her, it seems that after the Second World War, she's disappeared off the face of the earth. Have you managed to track her down?
Oh, we found her. Yes, I've found a grave as well.
Ah,
so
brilliant.
she died in February 1940 in Kensington.
All right.
But she, prior to living in Kensington, she lived in Brining or Ingatestone in Essex.
Right.
Ingatestone, yeah, right. In Essex. And when she died, she was actually buried in the churchyard there.
Right.
She hasn't got a headstone, but we've actually been to a plot.
Yeah.
And stuck there as well.
Right.
And we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah.
We don't know the rules and regulations of whether we're allowed to put some sort of marker there.
Well, we'll come back to that then, I think, because this is a remarkable story and it doesn't end with a memorial. It doesn't ever end. And there'll be more to this story as time goes forward. You're going to find some relatives, I'm sure you are. I'm sure there's going to be a development with Beatrice's burial ground as well, because it seems such a shame that she should be forgotten, and she won't be forgotten because of the work that you've done, and hopefully people will listen to this all around the world on this podcast, because lots of people can't get to the Somme to see these memorials, but I do know that people listen to this from all four corners of the earth, and it therefore takes his story all around the world, doesn't it, I think, hopefully.
Absolutely, yeah. and that's important. And if we're just building Houston's page now on the website as well. So there's going to be lots of photographs on there. There's going to be copies of the letters that Beatrice sent to the Commonwealth War Graves and their returns back. There's over 160 pages of documentation of letters between 19... Beatrice wrote to the Commonwealth War Graves 2 days after the armistice.
Really?
So on the 13th of November was her first letter asking where Houston was buried.
Yeah.
And the last letters are dated in 1926.
And did you go down to Maidenhead to find this, or did you find them all online, on their online archive?
This is on the archive of Beatrice's file is actually online.
Right.
You can download it.
But on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission archives?
Yes.
Brilliant.
Yes.
Right. That's a it's a very good resource, which I think a lot of people are not aware of. And they can
That's
find
right.
that
yep.
if
yep.
they go onto the Commission's website. and then just go to find records, search our archive. They can find all sorts of information there, can't they? And they're, and the commission, yeah, I know they're adding more and more records. That they've got millions of records in their archives, but they're adding more and more to the website all the time, aren't they? So it's a brand new resource, really, isn't it, for anoraks like me and you?
Absolutely.
Right. Thanks for that, Stephen. And please keep us updated, and we'll be talking about this, I think, more in the future. So thank you for that, mate.
You're welcome, Terry. Thanks for having me on.
There's just one other thing that I know Stephen wanted to share with me, which we forgot to mention in the interview, and that's a man called Michel Admiral, I think is how you pronounce his name, and he's the Western Front Association's European Field Officer, and I know that he gave Stephen a lot of help with the restoration of the project, so a special thanks, not just from Stephen, but from all of us, go out to him and his work. Back in the United Kingdom, 25 years after Houston had been killed, the world had been thrown into another war, perhaps an even greater war, with even more destruction, much more widespread than the First World War. And along the coast of Norfolk, in the United Kingdom, arrangements were being made to protect Britain as they feared the Germans would invade. And in a small holiday village of Mundersley near Cromer, I was visiting the other day and recorded two pieces about memorials from the Second World War, which I'd like to share with you now. So it means that this week's podcast is really about four memorials, two from the Great War and two from the Second World War. What's interesting about the two memorials from the Second World War, that all of the men that died, over 40 of them in total in these two stories, none of them died as a result of enemy action. And it just reminds us that war can claim lives in all sorts of different ways, but it's important that all of these people are remembered. It's the 19th of July, 1941. And HMS Umpire, a newly completed submarine commanded by an MRG Wingfield, was sailing from Chatham up to Clyde in Scotland. She joined a northbound convoy in transit through the North Sea. The North Sea that I'm looking out to now, it's quite calm today. The convoy was attacked by an Heinkel aircraft off the coast of Suffolk, and for the first time, the Umpire submarine dived safely to avoid the German attackers. Surfacing after the attack, her port engine became troublesome and had to be shut down, and she fell behind the rest of the boats in the convoy, and a motor launch was dispatched to escort her. But it was dark, very dark, and in the blackness of the night, she lost contact with the motor launch. She was on her own. Then she encountered a southbound convoy shortly after midnight. But in the darkness, they couldn't see each other. And there was an armed trawler called Peter Hendricks, and they collided with each other. And unfortunately, HMS Empire sank in 60 feet of water. Where she remains to this day, off the coast of Norfolk, just a few miles from where I'm standing now. 20 men were in the engine room and a smaller group in the control room. Four from the control room attempted an escape through the conning tower. With four men inside it, the tower was flooded and the hatch opened. All four managed to find their way to the surface, but only one of them was picked up by rescuers. In the engine room, a man called Killen took charge of the remaining survivors, and all of them escaped to the surface, but two of them didn't survive. Killen was the last man out, and he was awarded the British Empire Medal. Four men on the bridge of the submarine at the time of the collision, including the captain, also escaped, but only the captain survived. 16 of them were left behind. 16 of them drowned. only one of them has a grave, a known grave anyway, and I'm standing by his grave now. His name was Sub-Lieutenant Tony Godden, DSC. He was born in Hawley in Surrey in March 1916, and his father was a gunner in the Royal Field Artillery, Gunner Stephen Thomas Godden. He didn't survive the war, did his father? He died in action at the age of 40 in October 1918, and he's buried in Treport. He must have died of wounds if he's there, because that's on the coast, Normandy. In 1921, he was living in Lewisham in southeast London with his widowed mother. He joined the merchant service as an apprentice seaman. In October 1938, he was noted to be serving as a fourth mate on the P&O liner RMS Moulton. And his continuous certificate of discharge book noted him as being 6 foot 1.5 inches with blue eyes, light brown hair and a fresh complexion. And he was appointed as a probationary sub-lieutenant in the Royal Navy in March 1939. And in 1940, he was serving on the destroyer HMS Vimy, and he was deployed to support the Dunkirk evacuation. On the 27th of August 1940, he was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for good services in operations off the Dutch, Belgium and French coasts. And he became a third hand on HMS Empire in March 1941. And on the 10th of July 1941, the Empire joined in that East Coast convoy for passage from Chatham to Argyll in Scotland. And it was about a month later that his body was washed up on the shore below the cliffs that I'm standing at now, in a place called Mundersley, which many people in the United Kingdom will know because many people have been here and still come here on their summer holidays. It's a beautifully quiet place. The sun is out today. We've had several days of rain. But 3 days ago, on the anniversary of that awful accident, a brand new memorial was opened here and a service held. And it's just literally feet away from the final resting place of Stephen Anthony Golder Godden, DSC. The church that I'm standing in is called All Saints Parish Church in Mundersley. If you come to the church now, you'll find the memorial at the back of the church. There's a car park at the front, just off the main road. If you come round the back, facing the ocean, facing the very spot where Godden's body was washed up, you'll find his grave, you'll find the memorial. Local people raised the money for this splendid new memorial to be built. And on it, we've got the emblem, the badge of the Royal Navy Submariners. And it says, in memory of the brave Royal Navy Submariners who lost their lives in the sinking of HMS Empire off the Norfolk coast on the 19th of July 1941. And it lists 2, 4, 6, 8, the 16 names, including, of course, Godden. And next to it, there is another memorial with some more information. Simply tells us, on the 19th of July 1941, to the northwest of Cromer, the British submarine HMS Empire was in collision with the British armed trawler Peter Hendricks and sank. Although some of the crew escaped, 16 submariners lost their lives in this tragic accident. And this memorial and the nearby grave of Sub-Lieutenant Tony Godden, DSC, commemorate the lives of these brave submariners and will help to ensure that they're never forgotten. And by having that one headstone, that one grave to the only one's body was washed up on the shore, the only one that we know of that was washed up on the shore, it helps us to remember all of them. And I'm looking at his grave now. It's got a new headstone there. It's surrounded with a marble border. It's got his details on there. His life given for his country, but it's got the wrong date on. This was would have been the original grave marker, July the 20th, 1941. But now he has a Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone there. Doesn't have a family inscription on. That would indicate possibly they couldn't find the family. There are several others here, as you'd expect. If you go up and down the Norfolk coast, you'll find lots of Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstones remembering sailors that were washed up here in the Second World War. Just next to Godden lies an unknown sailor of the war, the Merchant Navy man. He was washed up here on the coast on the 29th of February 1940. It's a leap year, isn't it? 29th February. And then as you walk round, just by the back of the church wall, there's a Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone that remembers a man called Perry. Sergeant H.R. Perry, a wireless operator in the RAF, died in 3rd of April 1941 at that tender age of just 19. But his family have gone further than that, because he has his own private headstone with some flowers and a wooden cross and a stone that someone's painted with a poppy on it in loving memory of our dearest boy Hugh Raymond Perry, sergeant in the RAF, killed on an operational flight on the 3rd of April 1941-19. So young, so very brave. Always gets to me, that does. How can 19-year-old lad be up there in a plane fighting, sacrificing his life, the whole life that he had ahead of him? As we know, so many of those in the RAF died defending our nation, and then later in the war on bombing raids across occupied Europe and into Germany itself. And then there's another one from the First World War. Private M. Nesbitt, Royal Welsh Fusiliers, died on the 9th of April 1918, aged 18. Next to him lies a private memorial with two poppies on there, in loving memory of Archibald Scowell, the lieutenant in the Seaforth Highlanders, born in 1883, died on September 30th, 1915, early in the war. He doesn't have a Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone. He has a private headstone, and that's it. That's what the family chose. They could do that in the two wars. If their bodies, if they were buried here in the UK, not abroad, the family could choose whether to have a Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone, which would be maintained by the Commission forevermore, or they could choose to have their own private family headstone, which many of them have done, for lots of different reasons. And it's their responsibility then to maintain them. The Commission can't do it. And there, sometimes that hits problems, because families move away or they die out, and some of those graves become neglected. If a soldier, serviceman, servicewoman dies abroad, they have to be remembered or buried abroad. There was no repatriation after 1915. Very controversial decision, of course. Well, that was the decision that was made. That's history. But a few days ago, as I say, I was wandering up the coastal path here. And as I look up to my left, as I face the sea, I can see a gun emplacement, a massive gun emplacement, which reminds me of almost of the German defences in Normandy that Rommel built in 1944, but it's not. These are British coastal defences that were put here in 1940 with the imminent threat of German invasion after the fall of France. But those defences were never required. The Germans didn't arrive here. Operation Sea Lion, as Hitler was called it, didn't ever happen. But as I was wandering past there, I looked across to the church and I could see the uniforms of modern day sailors. It was just gone midday and the memorial was being unveiled, and we arrived just in time to see and listen to the unveiling and the dedication and the service that was beautifully carried out in front of what I would say probably 100 or so people. There were pupils here from the local junior school, and the unveiling was carried out by Vice Admiral Sir Ian Corder. And the ceremony was beautifully conducted by the vicar of the church here, Dr. Sally Myers. The history was carried out by the man, I think, that's done a lot of the work to raise the money for this memorial, a man called Peter Cudby. Hymns were sang, prayers were heard. The national anthem was played, as was the last post, as we remembered those 16 men that died. It took less than a minute, apparently, for that boat to go down in the North Sea. There's so many more wrecks out there. I believe that the wreck was found in 2016. And if you go onto YouTube and type it in, you can see images of divers that went down and looked at the wreck of HMS Umpire. And there was music at the ceremony as well. It was played by the Norfolk Broads Concert Band. And after 20 minutes or so, 2 minute silence was impeccably observed by everybody. Wreaths were laid. People bowed their heads. And I'm here now, a few days later. It's a beautiful summer's day. It's very quiet. There's only me here. I look back at that ocean, the North Sea, where the wreck of HMS Umpire lies beneath the surface out there somewhere, together with the 15 other poor souls that died that day, on the maiden voyage of HMS Umpire. We will remember them, won't we? We talk so much in the podcast about soldiers that died overseas on land, but the war took so many people from all the services in all sorts of different circumstances. Maybe if they hadn't been attacked by that German plane, the accident wouldn't have occurred. But that's a situation that did occur. We can't do anything about that now. I wonder what would have happened to those men if that incident hadn't happened, a tragic accident. But as I say, we will remember them. I've now come down to the centre of Mundersley village, as it's the start of the school holidays. It's a thriving, happy place. A couple of cafes, serving breakfast, holidaymakers, shops selling buckets and spades and other stuff that families can take down onto the beautiful sandy beach here. The tide is out. People are all in the sea, swimming, surfing. It's a safe, happy place. People just sitting on the benches, enjoying the summer sunshine. It's a far cry to what was going on here in 1940, because all along the coast here, the Norfolk coast, all the way down, all the beaches that surrounded the south and southeast of England, the beaches were mined, because, as I said earlier, after evacuation from Dunkirk, with no way of stopping the Germans bringing their enormous army and air force up to the northern French coast, the people of the United Kingdom feared the worst. The Germans were going to invade. And then came the Battle of Britain, which we now know prevented Operation Sea Lion from occurring. But those hundreds of thousands of mines were there. The beaches were cordoned off with barbed wire. They became no-go areas. And holidays were put away for five long years. And then the end of the war came in 1945, and those beaches, they had to be cleared. Those mines had never been used. No German had set foot on Mundersley Beach or any other beach. And most of them were successfully removed, safely destroyed, and the people came back to the East Coast, to Trimmingham, to Mundersley, to Weybourne, to Haysborough, to Hornsey, to see the seals. But there were accidents. Here in Mundersley, it's a wonderful memorial which has stood here for 20 years. So unveiled on May 2004. It's a brick base, and on top of it, it's one of those, a replica of one of those mines, painted green. And on one of the four sides of the memorial, it says, "This is a memorial to the many brave Royal Engineer bomb disposal personnel who were killed while clearing British landmines from the Norfolk coast between 1944 and 1953. So it's taken 9 years before those beaches are completely cleared. And we now know that there are still some that are out there. For millions of years, the tides have been crashing against the Norfolk cliffs and the beaches here, bringing fossils and secrets from the dinosaur period from millions of years ago. But as recently as Christmas Eve last year, 2024, somebody was swimming in the sea and they saw one of those undischarged landmines washed up on the beach. In the modern day, bomb disposal people had to be called in to take that away safely. You do wonder what else is out there, don't you? The memorial goes on. It says it is thanks to them and their colleagues that our cliffs and beaches are now safe for everyone to use and enjoy. Those who survived will never forget those who will not be forgotten. And then as you walk round the memorial, it lists the 27 men that died, not just here at Mundersley, but up and down the coast. Lance Corporal Vincent Goddard, age 24, killed on the 11th of December 1944 at Haysborough, about 5 miles or so at Trimmingham, just 2 miles up the coast. Two men there, Kenneth Braddock and Robert O'Doherty, both killed on the same day in the same explosion, the 6th of May 1953. At Weybourne, if you go to Weybourne now, there's a fantastic tank museum there, but three men died on the beaches there. Further north at Holcombe, there's two more that have died in December 1944. The Horsey, famous now for the seals, quite a few killed there. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 men have died on the beaches there. And on the final plaque, even further south down at Great Yarmouth, three men died all on the same day, 5th of January 1944, so when the war's still going on. Sapper Ernest Lord, Lieutenant Kenneth Perry, and Lance Sergeant John Richards have all died on the popular beach at Great Yarmouth. And two more at Caister, which is very near Great Yarmouth now, the scene of so many happy family holidays at Isaiah. Going on around me, people scoffing on their ice cream, people crossing the road with their buckets and spades, sudden cream lotion, ready to spend a happy day on these beaches, perhaps oblivious to those 27 men that gave their lives making those beaches safe for them to use. And then right next to the Royal Engineers memorial, it's the Coast Guard building, which tells us the tide times. High tide was at 5 o'clock this morning, low tide will be in a couple of hours' time at 11:52, 1 hour's time. It tells us that the watchkeeper is on duty between 9 and 6. every day of the year. And on the back of the Coast Guard building is a splendid memorial to the men of Mundersley, such a small village that fell in the Great War. Two columns, must be 40 or 50 on there. I had a quick look earlier and they all fell in those theatres of war that we're so familiar with at Ypres on the Somme. Beyond, there's a silhouette, the British Legion silhouette, on either side of the memorial guarding them. There's also a plaque remembering the men from the Second World War. There's a plaque remembering nurses, and another one that says remembering animals at war. And the whole memorial, it says, was funded and erected by the Mundersley-on-Sea Parish Council. And then as we look out to sea, there is a fence that protects people from the cliffs. There's a winding path that takes people down from the cliffs onto the sea, onto the beach, to prevent people from falling down the steep cliffs here. There's this iron fence. And round about the time of remembrance, out come more silhouettes. And they are fixed to this fence all along the coast here, and they remember, each of those silhouettes remembers one of those men from Mundersley that went off to war and didn't come back. And then after November the 11th, they're put away until the following year, and then they'll come out again every year remembering the sacrifice of the men from this beautiful little holiday village, Mundersley in North Norfolk. So I know that people listen to this from all over the world. They'll probably never get a chance to come here, but I know many people that come from the United Kingdom that will know this village, that have been to this village as children and maybe returned as adults. And if you do come here, come down to the centre of the village, pay your respects to those Royal Engineers, the bomb disposal boys, and go up to the church as well, just up the hill, a 5-minute walk, and remember those lads, those submariners that died beneath the surface in July of 1941. Thank you once again for tuning in to this very special unplanned episode of Tales from the Battlefields. Just a reminder that wherever we go, there's always evidence, stark reminders of those that went before us, and those that sacrificed, in most cases, their young lives so that we could live the life that we do today. We will remember them. Of course we will. I vow to thee, my country, is a very patriotic British hymn that was created in 1921. And to end the podcast this week, we're going to listen to the band of His Majesty's the Royal Marines singing it superbly a few years ago. It was played at the memorial service to those 16 Royal Naval Submariners, which is one reason why I wanted to end the podcast this week by playing it. But the other reason why I wanted to play it was in memory of one of the members of the Royal Marines band, a young lady called Sophie Ward. She died recently, aged just 27 years old, from motor neurones disease. Lieutenant Colonel Hugh Williams of the Royal Marines, the principal director of their band, said that she was a talented, cheerful and fiercely dedicated Royal Marine whose courage was an example to us all. She'd only been diagnosed with motor neurone disease the previous year. So as I say, I would like to dedicate this podcast to Sophie, and our thoughts, of course, go out to her friends and her family. And like all of the people that we've talked about this week, she will never, ever be forgotten.